Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, David Kunzman, and today we'll be talking with Carson Bay about his new book, Biblical Heroes in Classical Culture and Christian Late Antiquity. Carson is a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute of Jewish Studies at the University of Bern in Switzerland. And I hope you enjoy the interview for today. So we usually like to start our interviews by asking our guests just about their background and how did they come to write their current work. So Carson, how did you come to write Biblical Heroes in Classical Culture and Christian Late Antiquity?
This is an interesting question. So as a PhD student at Florida State University, my dissertation advisor, David Levinson, just happens to be probably the world's leading expert on the Latin Josephus tradition, which is to say the Latin translations of the Greek text of Flavius Josephus. And those Latin translations were made by Christian authors between the 4th and 6th centuries. And so the textual history of those works is highly complicated, but largely ignored within scholarship because they're not quote unquote primary sources, that, you know, they're not written by Josephus, they're translations. And so because of that aspect of David's expertise, he knows all things is something that I say, but because he was a Latin Josephus expert, I sort of got introduced to this text called De Excidio Hieris Limitano, or On the Destruction of Jerusalem, what I call Pseudo-Hegesippus. And one thing I discovered as a doctoral student is that very few people paid attention to this text. It wasn't read much. Very little was written on it, and it was kind of halfway dismissed as sort of a derivative work of Josephus's. And so, as I started to look into the text, as you know, in the first instance as part of my coursework for a Latin Josephus seminar, and then later on doing research and trying to find a good dissertation topic, I realized, wow, this text is really interesting, and there's a lot that could be said about it, and no one's really said it. I ended up writing my dissertation on one chapter of the work. So it was very narrow in focus because the chapter has so much in it, and that was really interesting. My dissertation was my first sort of like monograph length plunge into De Excidio. And then this book is a different project where I wanted to do a more sort of comprehensive study of the text. And this is a longer answer than your question merits. So I was sort of introduced into it because of who my Dr. Vater is, and because the text was has not been very popular amongst scholars. So,
in the subtitle, you mentioned Pseudo-Hegesippus, and I guess the reader would wonder if this relates to the historical Hegesippus, and why did how did that term come about in scholarship?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So the term actually comes from manuscripts. So beginning in the 9th century in the Latin manuscripts of De Excidio, of which there are many, but beginning in the 9th century, the text becomes more and more to be attributed to Hegesippus, often Egesippi in the genitive. And this seems to be a case in which scribes associated the author of this work with the 2nd century Greek writing Hegesippus, who's an important source of Eusebius and his church history, who wrote a 5-book Hupum Nemata. So he wrote a 5-book work. And of course, De Excidio is a 5-book work. And he also wrote about the time of the Acts, the time of the apostles, and Acts, and he wrote about, you know, goings on in Judea at that time. And he also seems to have been a Jewish convert. And so it seems that scribes sort of made that association. At the same time, there is one particular manuscript where you can see where the word Josephus, so the Latin for Josephus, used to be written, but that has been amended to read Egesippus. And so orthographically in the sort of front matter of the work, as it were, the manuscript tradition shows us that there was sort of a switch where this work was attributed to Josephus, and then it comes to be attributed to a Hegesippus. So there is no historical Hegesippus associated with De Excidio. It's very unlikely that the author was named Hegesippus, and if he was, that's just a complete random accident. And for the first, you know, half millennium of the work's existence, it seems to have been attributed to Josephus. Whether or not scribes and readers actually thought Josephus wrote the work is a question that's up for some debate. And so this is something about which, or over which Richard Matthew Pollard and I disagree. Richard Matthew Pollard being one of the most prominent scholars writing on De Excidio today at the University of Quebec, who's done a lot on the work. And so he thinks that these early authors thought that De Excidio was a work of Josephus. And my idea is that it's very reasonable to assume that these authors might call De Excidio the work of Josephus, in the same way that someone might call a Latin paraphrase of Homer's Iliad a work of Homer, you know, knowing that Homer didn't write it, but also understanding that it's a Homeric story. So anyway, that's a very long answer to your question, but the short answer is there is no historical Hegesippus. It seems to be sort of a conflation between the historical Hegesippus who wrote on similar things and the orthographic similarities in Latin between the names for Josephus and Hegesippus.
I know in the book you sort of criticize the scholarly enterprise of fixating on trying to find authorship of the sort of De Excidio. Why do you think scholarship is so fixated on trying to find the author behind the work?
Oh, yeah, this is a good question. And I hope that, I wouldn't criticize that in the sense that I would say this is something we shouldn't do or this is a silly thing to do. I mean, of course it's not. It's a very, very natural thing to do. I would say it's impossible because of the way our minds work. It's impossible for us to come across an artifact, a human artifact like a text, and not to ask who wrote this, when, why, where, all these detailed questions. But so the criticism I brought up is a criticism articulated by Michel Foucault and resurrected recently by, for example, Hindy Nyman, who's a prominent scholar of Second Temple Judaism. And so the criticism is we tend to lean very heavily on those historical details when reading a text, to the extent that it can really sort of shape our understanding of a text in ways that are not always helpful and or accurate. In the case of a work like De Excidio, I think the real problem is that the fact that we don't, that we cannot easily associate it with an author leaves open this field of questions for scholarship, and those end up getting pursued to the detriment of the actual reading and discussion of the text itself. Case in point here, the history of scholarship on De Excidio has been highly weighted towards trying to figure out who the author of the work was. Was it Ambrose of Milan? You know, scholars have argued about this, and this is sort of one of the main things that scholars have argued about vis-a-vis De Excidio. Then you have, you have scholars suggesting other authors, Isaac the Jew, about whom we know almost nothing, was sort of an acquaintance of Jerome. And, you know, maybe he wrote it because it seems like certain features of the work point to a Jewish convert author. I mean, these kinds of suggestions have very little to recommend them. There are reasons for these suggestions. So when Albert Bell says Evagrius of Antioch maybe is the author of De Excidio, I mean, he gives some very compelling reasons for thinking so. But the criticism, which again is not a sharp, it's a sort of Jussive criticism, like let's get past this and read the text. The criticism is, that's an interesting question, but I don't think we can know. And actually, I think much more interesting questions await us in the text itself. So all that's to say, despite the fact that we do not, and I think probably cannot know who the author of De Excidio was, nevertheless, we can learn a lot from the text. We can study the text in almost the same way we'd study the text. We'd study a text written by Ambrose or Augustine or Jerome, to name three roughly contemporary Latin writing authors. So that's the criticism, as it were.
So getting to the actual work of De Excidio, could you just please unpack, I guess, the overall structure of the work, and what do you think Pseudo-Hegesippus was trying to accomplish by writing this work?
Yes. So it's a five-book work that basically follows the narrative arc of Josephus's Jewish War, or the Bellum Judaicum. So for those who aren't familiar with that, that basically tells the story of the second half of what's usually called the Second Temple period of Jewish history. The Second Temple period spanning from the construction of the Second Temple, the second Jewish temple that existed in Jerusalem, in the last quarter of the 6th century BCE, up until 70 CE, when that temple was destroyed by the Romans and, of course, has never been rebuilt since. So De Excidio tells the second half of that story, beginning with the infamous rule in Judea of the Seleucid ruler Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, who, to simplify things greatly, basically tried to do away with Jewish culture and the religious cult. For various reasons, none of which were very good. And so De Excidio begins the story there, but then very quickly moves up to the first century of the Common Era, and most of the narrative is occupied with the last few years before the temple's destruction in 70 CE. So in particular, The story focuses on the 4-year period of what we usually call the Roman Jewish War from 66 to 70 CE, which ends with the destruction of Jerusalem and is sometimes sort of conceptually continued for 3 or 4 more years until 74 CE, when this great final battle, didn't happen atop Mount Masada, where almost 1,000 Jewish rebels were sort of holed up. And so that's sort of like the last big event of this clash between the Judeans, or the Jews, that is to say, the inhabitants of the Roman province of Judea, and the Romans. So Deexcidio, which means on the destruction of Jerusalem, Deexcidio hieris limitano. It tells the story of this destruction of Jerusalem, and it gives a lot of backstory. Now, to the second part of your question, what do you think the author, whom I'm calling Pseudo-Hegesippus, what do I think he was doing, or what do I think he thought he was doing with the work? Luckily, the author kind of tells us this in the prologue. So there's a short prologue to the work where the author basically says, so I previously wrote the story of the 4 books of the kingdoms, and which is to say 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, the historical books of the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Old Testament. And he said, I also penned the Res Gestae of the Maccabees. So I wrote a history of the Maccabean period. And he says, here I've followed things all the way up to the destruction of the temple. And the reason he said he did this is because Josephus in Latin, Josephus, he says, gives us a really good historical account, but he did not understand non-intellexit. He did not understand the cause, the reason for Jerusalem's destruction, and for the author of Deexcidio, the Christian author of Deexcidio, the reason for this is sort of built into his Christian worldview. He would have said it was obvious, and that is, Jerusalem was destroyed because the Jews rejected and crucified their would-be Messiah, Jesus Christ, and as a result, God rejected the Jews. He abandoned them in history. The temple's destruction, Jerusalem's destruction in 70 by the Romans, is proof positive of that. And so, not in so many words, but basically, the author lays out that understanding in the short prologue to the work. And then you can trace throughout the work a number of nods, some of them subtle, some of them not so subtle, to this understanding. So I think it's very safe to say that that is what the author understood himself to be doing in writing this work, was basically updating the account of Josephus, which was historiographically very valuable and very well done, but which was, let's say, theologically and philosophically incomplete, because Josephus, as not a Christian, didn't understand the theological causality at work in this sequence of historical events.
As penned by a Christian, are there any Christian material in Deexcidio, or is it just dealing with the material of Josephus's war on the Jews?
Yeah, there's a very little bit of Christian material in the work, and that's actually a very interesting fact. That's actually one of the primary reasons that I find it very difficult to imagine Ambrose of Milan, the famous bishop, having penned this work, is because it is so unchristian for a Christian work, just in terms of quantity and content. At the same time, at the work's very beginning, in the prologue, once again, the author betrays himself as a Christian. So he, at the end of the prologue, he refers to the Spes Gentium, the hope of nations, which is a Christian reference to Jesus Christ, attached to a prophecy in Genesis 49:10 about Judah, the tribe of Judah, the figure of Judah, occasionally through the narrative, you get these nods to the Christian perspective of the author. So, for example, you get verbatim and allusive quotations of New Testament passages from the Gospels, from the Epistles. At one point in Book 5, when he's describing the temple, the author refers to an idea of the Trinity that existed within the utensils and furniture that was inside the temple. And so the author is not only Christian, but betrays himself this one time as a Trinitarian Christian, which isn't unusual, but it's interesting that it happens. In 5.2, right at the beginning of Book 5, this is a long chapter upon which I wrote my dissertation, where the author talks to Jerusalem and its inhabitants, the Jews, almost talks at them and sort of explains across 1,500 Latin words why Jerusalem was destroyed, the fact that it didn't have to be that way, but, you know, this is what happens when you reject your would-be savior. And so a number of times throughout that speech, the author, you know, explicitly talks about Jesus and uses kind of Christian theological language and this sort of supersessionist ideology in framing that. And you have a few other passages where that happens as well. Toward the end of Book 5, you have some Christian material. The last thing to say in this regard maybe is the only time where actual Christian characters appear in the work is right in the middle of it. In 3.2, you have this insertion of this vignette that records the martyrdoms of the apostles Peter and Paul, whom the author refers to as Doctores Christianorum, so doctors of the church. And so there you get a really interesting story from the apocryphal Acts of Peter, where Peter has a showdown with his arch nemesis, Simon Magus, Simon the Magician, who also appears in Acts 8 in the New Testament. And so you get this version of the showdown where Peter basically embarrasses Simon. Simon happens to be a courtesan of the Emperor Nero, so Nero's really mad about this. And Peter and Paul end up dead at the end of that episode. But it's very interesting because nowhere else in the work do Christian actors appear. And that narrative is not really tied closely to the surrounding narrative. So it's almost like it's inserted there for kind of a particular reason. And this is actually the argument of chapter 5 in the book, is that the insertion of this martyrdom story is designed to contrast with this story of Matthias in 5:22:1, who's portrayed as like a non-martyr, to show that there are legitimate martyrs and illegitimate martyrs in this same period. And the legitimate martyrs were these Christian leaders. And the illegitimate martyrs were Jews like Matthias, who got killed because they made bad decisions. Anyway, so that's a long answer to a simple question. But yes, occasionally we have evidence of the author's Christian perspective, but it's surprisingly sparse given the size of the work.
And I know Josephus doesn't mention the historical Jesus in the War of the Jews, only maybe in the Antiquities. Is there any reference to the historical Jesus at all?
Yes. So the passage you reference from Josephus's Jewish Antiquities, chapter 18, section 60, 64 and 65, according to the modern sections. This is called usually the Testimonium Flavianum, and it's a much discussed passage in Josephus. These days, most scholars assume that it's actually it's a later insertion into the text made by someone like Eusebius of Caesarea. But that the Testimonium Flavianum, in a slightly different form, does indeed appear in De Excidio. It's one of several passages that De Excidio takes from Josephus's Jewish Antiquities. The Jewish War which Josephus wrote 30 years earlier, around 75 CE, is of course the primary source for De Excidio. But the Jewish Antiquities is also a source. And so that's the in De Excidio 212.1, the author inserts the Testimonium Flavianum with some surrounding discussion into the narrative which follows the Jewish war. So it's very interesting that that happens. What's particularly interesting about it is that it's not the exact language that Josephus uses in his own Testimonium Flavianum. One of the very provocative things about Josephus's statement is that at least in the Greek text that is extant in the manuscripts of the Jewish Antiquities, Josephus makes this statement, you know, he was the Christ, period. And this is something that scholars have taken great interest in for good reason, because Josephus is a Jewish author, the priest turned general turned historian, and there's no good kind of historical reason to assume that he would have seen Jesus as the Messiah or a Messiah, but just based upon the text of his that we have. I mean, it seems that he said that was the case, and in De Excidio's version of this, that's not played up in the same way, which is interesting.
Another dichotomy that's interesting in De Excidio is that the separation between the virtuous Hebrew and the Jew.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, where does this dichotomy, like, where's the end point of where a Hebrew ends and a Jew begins? Like, where in the chronology?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the answer is, it's kind of fuzzy. So depending upon kind of what passage you're looking at in the text or what metric you're using to measure it, you could say that the Hebrew-Jew divide, as it were, sort of breaks between the Maccabees and the post-Maccabean period. That's one way that's reasonable to think about it. So the Maccabees are associated with the Hebraei in De Excidio and the Udai later on. But then the author also talks about the infamous Queen Jezebel as a Jew or as a Jewess. And so you have Udai that are located all the way back in Israel's earlier history. And so clearly it's not the chronological divide is not super cut and dry. At the same time, you have Josephus in the last speech he gives to his countrymen in De Excidio 5, 15, and 16, where he's trying to convince them, like, don't keep resisting the Romans because it's going to end badly for you. He calls his listeners Hebraei in that speech. And so it's part of this maybe sort of patriotic national colloquialism, like a way of speaking to Jewish contemporaries. But so all that's to say that both chronologically and linguistically, the divide is not crystal clear throughout the work. And this is actually, I would say, something that is that should be expected when it comes to language that represents what we would call national and or ethnic and or racial identity. The divide between the two is actually, as I argue in chapter two, is more ethical, moral, and evaluative than anything else. And so for De Excidio, the idea is that the Udai are basically faithless, impious, and not virtuous in ways that form a complete contrast with their ancestors, the Hebrews. And one of the main points in chapter four, the chapter on Jewish historical decline, is that this kind of rhetoric was very common in the ancient Mediterranean world writ large. I would say it's fairly common in world history. And it was very common in the Christian thought of late antiquity. And so you have authors like Ephraim and Epiphanius and Eusebius, and, you know, all of these Christian authors sort of saw a similar qualitative difference between the Hebrews and the Jews if they made that distinction. And so a number of scholars have written about this better than I have. So Aaron Johnson is an example. Christine Shepherdson in her work on Ephraim the Syrian has talked about it.
And it seems like Pseudo-Hegesippus applies a Greek and Roman historiographical term to the Hebrew, which is called exempla. Could you just please unpack what exempla, how it functions?
So the Latin term exemplum, or the plural exempla, refer to, I mean, it is basically like our word examples in a lot of ways, but it's also closely associated with something that classicists call a discourse of exemplarity. And in particular, there's a Roman discourse of exemplarity that becomes very prominent in ancient Latin literature and in the ancient Roman cultural milieu writ large. And so the discourse of exemplarity is a discourse wherein exempla from the ancestral past, which is to say, sort of famous stories and the heroes that act in them, become these points of reference for thinking about and talking through and debating everything from ethics to politics to philosophy and economic policy to religion. You know, how do you know what's noble and ignoble? How do you know what's right and wrong? How do you know what it is to be brave or a coward, or patriotic or unpatriotic? And for the Romans, the way that they tended to answer these questions was to say, well, look back at this character and this thing he did or she did this one time that embodies this virtue or this vice. And they would use, and this was sort of like the Roman benchmark for that idea or that moral value. That's something that scholars call the discourse of exemplarity. And prominent scholars writing in this recently include Rebecca Langlands at the University of Exeter and Matt Roller at the Johns Hopkins University. They both wrote books on this subject in 2018. So De Excidio uses the term exempla a number of times and in a number of places. The term exempla is being used in a character's speech within the narrative, and the character is referring to biblical heroes, which is to say figures of the Christian Old Testament, as exempla, as examples that exemplify something. So, for example, when Josephus and his comrades, after the Battle of Jotapata, which occurred in 67 CE, but after the Battle of Jotapata, they find themselves in this cave, and they end up having an argument. And this is a famous argument where Josephus is thinking about capitulating to the Romans, about giving himself up to Vespasian, who said, give yourself up, come over, and we won't kill you. And Josephus's comrades are incredulous that he's even considering this. And they say, how could you even think about doing that? You know, don't be a coward, be a patriot, don't be impious, be pious. And they say, they give the example of Saul, who famously killed himself rather than be captured by the Philistines in the biblical record. And then Josephus responds, and he says, he calls Saul egregium exemplum, a famous example of someone to whom the grace of God was lacking. And so he says Saul's suicide is actually a great example of what not to do in a situation like this. Like, you don't commit suicide because Josephus's argument is that suicide is highly impious and is something that God does not approve of, and that Saul's suicide provides an example of why not to do this. Like Saul finds himself in a really bad situation, makes a really bad decision. So it's a negative example, something that teaches us what not to do. So the premise of my book is that the biblical figures that appear in De Excidio, which most often appear in speeches made by characters within the narrative, function as exempla in the same way that all of the many ancestors of the Romans functioned for rhetoricians like Cicero as exempla. So that's where exempla comes from.
And De Excidio is littered with mentions of biblical figures from the Hebrew Bible. I guess my next question is that how much of Pseudo-Hegesippus's exemplar characteristics, how much of that is received knowledge from previous exegesis of the Hebrew Bible? And how much of that is his own, I guess, productive creative work?
Okay, David, here you've hit on a really, really interesting question and kind of a tough one, especially because the author does not explicitly engage with his, shall we say, hermeneutical and exegetical interlocutors in as much as he had them. At the same time, some of the interpretive moves the author makes are common in ancient Christianity. So, for example, in the prologue, when he mentions when he makes a reference to this prophecy in Genesis 49:10, where the scepter shall not depart from Judah, which is Christians read this as a prophecy that a ruler of Israel would come from the tribe of Judah, and Christians associated that prophecy with Jesus Christ. So this is something that Eusebius and a number of other Christian authors had referenced before Pseudo-Hegesippus does. So there he's falling in line with a Christian reading of Scripture. And of course, all of the biblical episodes that this author is talking about, at some point he learned how to kind of read and interpret these biblical texts in this way. So in the sense that education and intellectual formation constitutes a kind of tradition, which is to say a passing on in the sense of traditio, the Latin term. So in that sense, Pseudo-Hegesippus will have, kind of learned a lot of the readings that he provides or implies. At the same time, the way that Pseudo-Hegesippus is using his Old Testament is relatively unusual within ancient Christian literature, especially literature of the fourth century and before, inasmuch as the author is treating his Old Testament as a history book. And so he's reading in this kind of historical manner, which historically scholarship might have associated with what's called the literal school of interpretation, which has been linked to Antioch. So there's this Antiochene school, which is opposed to the Alexandrian school, which tends toward allegorical readings. That's been shown to be a little simplistic. But anyway, so the author's treating the Old Testament as a history book. What's really interesting about it is that the author does relatively little theologization. So there's not a lot of Christology kind of drawn out or pushed onto the Old Testament text, however you're inclined to view it. There's not a lot of what would be called mystical or spiritual or, again, allegorical reading. There's not a lot of practical emphasis. So almost never does the author, take an Old Testament text and say anything that has anything to do with the Christian life or the operation of the Christian church, which in terms of the genre of Deus Scidio is, of course, very, very natural. Like it's hard to imagine how you could easily make that jump from a work that's from a historical work like this to, you know, this is how Christians should act. At the same time, it's interesting because very few authors do that kind of writing in the ancient within the ancient Christian context. And so one of the overarching points of the book is to point out that Deus Scidio is valuable for our understanding of ancient Christianity because the author is doing something that is so, in many ways, unusual within ancient Christianity, which is to say, writing a kind of classical sounding historiography, you know, not doing theology, not doing dogmatics, not doing doctrine, just doing history. And so he treats, you know, when he mentions Old Testament figures, which get mentioned a lot, they're treated as historical figures, usually being remembered by characters within the narrative. So anyway, that's, and the last thing I'll say here, David, is that it does seem that a lot of the readings that Deus Scidio provides for the biblical stories and characters that he mentions are not unprecedented within earlier Christian tradition. So he doesn't seem to be totally out in left field. At the same time, we do find a lot of what appear to be very, very original, which is to say, kind of unusual presentations of biblical characters and episodes, whether that's in the choice and framing of an episode or character, or in an evaluation thereof. So I'll give one example. So in Josephus's, in his final speech in Deus Scidio 5:16:1, where he's talking to the Jews, telling them not to resist the Romans, he goes through this really long list of biblical exemplars, the longest list in the work. And at one point, he's talking about how all these biblical characters conquered through faith. And there you can see a sort of, it's an easy link between that list and Hebrews 11, which is all about faith, pistis or fides in the Latin. And he talks about how David conquered at one point through his union with Bathsheba. And so the author has Josephus present David's infamous sort of affair with Bathsheba as a mark in the win column for David's career. Whereas, you know, basically every reader of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible in antiquity and today recognizes the Bathsheba episode as a low point in David's career. And yet Pseudo-Hegesippus has Josephus presented as a win, like literally as a win. He uses the verb winko. So like David won when he did this. And so that's an example of a reading of a biblical passage that is, maybe it was inherited. So there are a few works of late antiquity that also go there. But it's pretty original. And so it's very clear, whatever else one wants to say, it's very clear that the author of Deus Scidio was very comfortable dealing with the biblical material and was certainly capable of generating and articulating original readings and formulations vis-a-vis biblical tradition. But it's an important question, so thank you.
And was Deus Scidio influential subsequently in Christendom after it was written?
Oh man, this is maybe the question for an interview like this, David. I'm glad you asked it. And so, really, the expert here is Richard Matthew Pollard, whom I mentioned before, and a number of other people have written on Deus Scidio's reception as well. So the German scholar Heinz Schreckenberg, back in the 80s, did a lot of work on this. Deus Scidio was incredibly influential, starting already in late antiquity, but throughout late antiquity and the Middle Ages, De Excidio gets read and copied and cited all over the place by prominent authors like the Venerable Bede, like Isidore of Seville. The number of manuscripts of De Excidio that exist in itself is a testament to how wildly popular this text was in the Latin Middle Ages. And so I have down something like 80 manuscripts that I list in the book here. But the list at present is up to, is moving towards 200 manuscripts and manuscript fragments of De Excidio that exist. We're still actually finding manuscripts and parts of manuscripts as we search for them. There's no comprehensive list. But this is something that Richard Pollard and his student Felix Proban are working on. So the manuscript tradition and the number of authors and the type of authors in which De Excidio makes an appearance. People cite him. This was a widely read text, and it seems to have been enthusiastically read, and it was copied. So and it was very very important for later Christian readers. And a lot of times it was associated with the wider Latin Josephus tradition, by which I mean the Latin translation of the Jewish War, the actual translation of that work, which seems to have appeared in the 4th century. We don't know who did that. And the Latin translation of the Jewish Antiquities, which was produced under the supervision of Cassiodorus in the 6th century. And so you'll have manuscripts that has De Excidio with one or both of these works in it as well. And so Pollard has an essay on this. And the title is, it's like Flavius Josephus, the most influential classical historian of the Middle Ages, or something like that. And he makes this point just based upon number of extant manuscripts that the Josephus tradition represents the most influential historiographical tradition from the classical age among medieval readers. And so Pseudo-Hegesippus was part of that. Pseudo-Hegesippus also is an early and a very important voice for articulating a Christian supersessionary understanding of history, which is to say the sort of the Christian historical theological understanding of Jews and Judaism, which sees Jews as the descendants of the ancient Hebrews and Israelites who sort of gave up their inheritance when they rejected Jesus and were in turn rejected by God, which is why Jerusalem was destroyed. That Christian understanding, which has been very common from antiquity to today, was articulated more forcefully in De Excidio than in any other text up to that time. And so that, combined with the fact that De Excidio was manifestly copied and read often, by points to the influence and the importance of this text historically. So, yes, is the shorter answer.
So you would say that De Excidio was a huge contributor to Christian anti-Semitism?
I would want to make a distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism, and I would also want to make a distinction between even anti-Judaism and supersessionism. But yes, Pseudo-Hegesippus made a massive contribution to what can be considered the anti-Jewish interpretation of history that came to be a Christian commonplace already in late antiquity. And so I outlined this in an article called Writing the Jews Out of History, which appeared in Church History a couple of years ago, the journal Church History. But this book is also one of the big kind of things that this book is designed to show is in detail how Deic Scidio sort of contributes to this this piece of the history of thought, if you will.
And is there any evidence of Deic Scidio's influence reaching beyond the Catholic world and into either what later becomes Orthodox or Protestant?
Yes, I mean the distinction between Catholic and the various brands of non-Catholic is that distinction doesn't work in the fourth century when Deic Scidio is written, and it's always complicated. But I guess another way to think about it is, so Deic Scidio remained a part of Latin reading Christendom for most of its life. Deic Scidio itself never seems to have been translated as such into another language until the early modern period, when it finds its way into French and German and Italian. And some of these contexts would likely have been Protestant by that point, or proto-Protestant maybe. Deic Scidio was definitely read by Protestants later on. And so starting in the early modern period, Deic Scidio, as with Josephus, remains an important work in both Catholic and non-Catholic Christian circles. Perhaps the most interesting trajectory of Deic Scidio's historical influence is the way it makes itself into the Jewish milieu and then back into Christian milieus in Semitic languages. So Deic Scidio is the most important source for an early 10th century work called Sefer Yosipan, which is a work written in classical Hebrew, which retells the story that Deic Scidio was trying to retell, which is, the story told in Josephus's Jewish War, but now from a Jewish perspective, and it being written in Hebrew, it was written for Jewish readers. So this text is exceptional. This is actually the text I'm writing my next book about. But so Deic Scidio was the most significant and the most quantitatively, the most deeply used source by Sefer Yosipan. And so there are places where it kind of just gets translated into the Hebrew. But then that Hebrew text becomes the basis for Christian Arabic translations, which make their way into translations in Ge'ez, or classical Ethiopic. So my colleague, Yonatan Binyam, with whom I went to graduate school, he wrote his dissertation on this topic. So he's an expert on the Hebrew Sefer Yosipan and its transformation into Christian Coptic Arabic and Ethiopic. And so Deic Scidio's sort of broad storyline and some of its language and ideas and what have you, they get spread a little more broadly in that way through the accidents of textual transmission and translation. But Deic Scidio in itself, as a sort of as a block text, remains in the Latinate sphere for the most part, but that's not to say that it was only a Catholic text historically. So
my next question is, in terms of modern translations, if one wanted to read Deic Scidio, just say in English, could one go to just say Amazon and get a copy?
No. Translations into any modern language don't really exist. So Dominique Estève's 1987 French dissertation contains a French translation of the first four books, which is pretty well done. But it's an unpublished dissertation. It's very difficult to access. There actually doesn't exist an adequate English translation of De Excidio at all. So Wade Blocker, who is kind of an amateur reader of Latin, produced a Latin translation of the text sort of for fun, is one way of saying it. And this got put online in 2005 by Roger Pierce. And so you can find that translation online. So that translation provides access basically to what Pseudo-Hegesippus says. It can't really be cited. It's not like, if you look at it next to the Latin, you can't use it to do any real kind of close textual reading. But at the same time, like you can go through it and it tells you basically, it shows you what De Excidio is, what it's about. So both the format of the text and the nature of the translation make it sort of difficult to sled through, because a lot of the times it almost looks like someone sort of copied and pasted it into Google Translate, and like that's what you get. It's highly literal. It's a little bit wooden. At the same time, it's useful because it's the only thing that the non-Latin reader has. And even if you're reading the Latin, it takes a very long time, because De Excidio's Latin is not simple and easy in the way that certain Christian Latin texts from that period are. So I've emailed briefly with David Hunter, who edits the Fathers of the Church series by Catholic University of America Press. And so I tentatively anticipate producing an English translation of De Excidio within the next decade, or maybe even half decade. Yeah, right now the text is not particularly accessible, which is unfortunate.
So before we go, we usually like to ask our guests just what upcoming projects they have. But before I ask you that, I guess the last question I have about this work is, what did you find most surprising during your research?
So I guess... this takes me back a ways, but what I found most surprising was just the basic answer to my research question, which I mentioned a couple of times in the introduction, and that is, what are the differences between the way that biblical figures appear and are used in Josephus's Jewish War versus De Excidio, and what does that mean? So when I first asked that question, I hadn't surveyed De Excidio and counted all of its mentions of biblical characters, and I did not realize that the text contains mentions of biblical characters way beyond what we find in Josephus's Jewish War. And so that surprised me, but it also made me very happy, because it reinforced a conviction that I already had, which was that De Excidio is not the same as Josephus's Jewish War, and it can't be treated as a sort of paraphrastic translation of that work. It has to be understood as a work in its own right, even if it is drawing upon a literary source. And this is something that I think readers of De Excidio, or people who are kind of interested in De Excidio, have had a hard time accepting or putting into practice, because it's when a work is largely based on a previous work, there's something about the I it seems. There's something about the modern scholarly imagination that just wants to dismiss it as not original or something like that. But one thing that the presence of biblical figures in Dei Excidio show is that the text is very original in very interesting ways.
And do you have any upcoming projects that you're working on?
Yeah, I have a bunch. Let's see. So I'm finishing editing a volume with Jan Willem van Henten and Michael Avios, my senior colleagues. The title is From Josephus to Yosipan and Beyond. And so what that's an edited volume with sort of a number of state-of-the-art essays on Josephus's Greek text and Sefer Yosipan, the Hebrew text I mentioned earlier, and the reception of one or both of those texts in later literature. So that's a big volume that should, I think, shake things up in certain sort of scholarly subcircles. I'm also finishing a monograph on the Hebrew Sefer Yosipan and its use of Dei Excidio. So that's sort of in some ways, it's a natural sort of next step in terms of scholarly questions. And so that's a very interesting project as well. And so those are two projects I've been working on of late.
So I think that's all the time we have for today. Carson, thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you, David.